sleep. To be. Okay, I'm ready when you are.
I'm ready. What's up, Let's girls and gays?
Girls, gays, and bays.
Welcome back to Rate, Debate, Recreate. I'm Sammy Purcell.
And I'm Logan Keller.
We're back for episode 15. Logan.
Oh, my God. Yes, Sammy.
I have a question for you. Yes. As a white passing boy, have you ever gone looking for yourself and on the way you found Ruth Gladys? Just kidding. This is a Chicago reference. But
like, Rosemary.
And Irving. Yeah, we've all been there. It's fine. But have you ever, in all seriousness, have you ever like felt the need to find yourself? And you're just really looking for yourself, and it didn't... How did it go? That's the question.
Yeah, that's a great question, Sammy. I have been on an existential journey or two during my time.
Sure.
And, you know, it's going.
It's still going.
I don't know that we can assign if it's going well or not, but it's just happening.
Hasn't come to a definitive end yet. Well, that's good to hear. Could go either way. But... this week on our show, Rate, Debate, Recreate, which we'll explain what that's all about, we're going to be delving into those deep, deep trips, discoveries of yourself.
White boy tries to find himself, ends badly.
Ends badly. That's the category. Excuse me, I can't talk. But anyway, welcome back to Rate, Debate, Recreate, y'all. On the show, just for a little bit of background, if you're new... Logan and I each week will pick a show, a musical, and we'll rate that show on a scale of 1 to 10. Sorry, I really can't talk today. And then we'll engage in a little friendly discussion about which one is better. And then we'll rethink one aspect of that show that we would change and recreate it because we're the experts. We know better than anyone who's actually working on Broadway jokes, all of them. Just kidding. But as we said, we have a category each week, and as Logan so eloquently pointed out, this week that category is shows about white boys, typically, that's not set in stone, it shouldn't be anyway, who try and find themselves, and then it all just goes downhill from there. And my show is Spring Awakening.
And my show is Pippin.
Excellent. All right.
Excuse me. Oh, go ahead.
Before we get started, should we go into the white boy thing? So typically in these shows, it is a white male who engages in a little bit of self-discovery, and it doesn't go well. But it doesn't have to be a white male. In fact, we'd prefer it not to be, I guess.
Like, just to be 100% clear, the category name is, like, if anything, more of a jab at how these shows have, like, always been done than a... saying of how we see the protagonist, but I personally have seen
an estimation of
shitloads of video. Yeah, for real. I've seen shitloads of videos of both Spring Awakening and Pippin, and I don't think I've ever seen a person of color in the lead male roles.
No.
So
please,
I'm just associating them with
videos,
white boys.
You found videos?
Yeah,
on
for real. I want to see.
Definitely send them our ways. I'd love to see them. But in Logan said it great. I'm not going to elaborate. Anyway, so should we get started with a little bit of summary?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. I'll get started. And before I start, I do want to give a little bit of a content warning just because Spring Awakening deals with a lot of heavy issues. So we're going to get into talk about sexual assault, suicide, sexual abuse, child abuse. So if any of that is difficult for you, just be warned. We are going to get into that. So, Spring Awakening is a rock musical with music by Duncan Sheik, and is that how you say his name? I don't think I've ever said
that
out loud.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't either, but that's how I say it in my head.
Yeah, okay, awesome. And lyrics and book by Steven Sader, and it's based on the very controversial German 19th century play. I think it was written in the 19th century, but he didn't actually, like, get to... It wasn't actually, like, put on until the 20th century because it was, you know, scandalous.
Risqué.
Yes. by a German 19th century play by Frank Wedekind. I don't know if that's how you say that, but props to him. And the play and musical are both set in 19th century Germany and basically criticize the sexually oppressive culture of that time period in Germany. So the show follows a group of school children. I think they're all around like 13, 14. And basically they go through puberty and their discovery of sexuality in their extremely repressed communities. So you've got Fenla, Ilsa, Martha, Thea, and Anna. Those are the girls. And the boys, you have Moritz, Melchior, Ernst, Hanschen. Don't know if that's right, but okay. Otto and Georg. I know that's, I'm pretty sure that's how you say that, because that's Captain Von Trapp's name. But anyway, so a lot of stuff happens in this musical. I'll just go through some of the main points. But basically, all the kids are dealing with a bunch of really horrible shit. So Moritz is not very good in school, but he tries really, really hard. He barely passes his midterms. So that's like the big deal for them. But the teachers fail him anyway, like claiming they can't pass everyone. I don't really understand why, but that's their tea. And
1800s, it was a different time.
They're like, we just simply cannot pass everyone. And so his parents are, his dad is fairly abusive, and he ends up dying by suicide. Then you have Martha, who her father is sexually abusing her, and she tells the other girls, but asks them not to tell anyone because she doesn't want to end up like Ilsa, who was also abused by her father and spoke up about it and was kicked out of the house. And then the main person, the main girl that you kind of follow the whole time is Fenla, who's played by Lea Michele, of Glee fame. She is growing up and she has some questions, but no one ever wants to answer them. So she's like, she asks her mother where babies come from at the beginning of the show. And her mom basically says like, well, when a husband and wife love each other very much, you have a baby. Which is just like, not the way to explain that, whatever. And she's a crush on Melchior, who's played by Jonathan Groff. And I think he's a bit older than her, but regardless, he is, like, more worldly than all the other kids. I think he's, like, a bit older, and he's, like, kind of mysterious, and most of the girls have a crush on him. And he has a crush on Fenla as well, and their storyline is kind of the main one, and they end up having a sexual encounter that we will talk about later. There's a lot of iterations of it, and in my opinion, they all spell rape. But Fenla gets pregnant, but is obviously confused because her mom told her that can only happen if she was married. So that's confusing. And she also ends up dying from a botched abortion. So it was a legal abortion gone wrong. And the other large thing that happens after Moritz dies, the adults try to blame someone for it because it's like a direct consequence of their actions of not passing him, even though he passed. So they try to find someone else to blame. The adults are evil in the show. And they find an essay that Melchior wrote for Moritz, basically like explaining what sex is, and they decide that that must have been the reason that he went through with it, and Melchior is sent to reform school, and lots of stuff happens. It's really dark.
It's heavy.
It's extremely dark. It's very heavy. Yeah, and I have some thoughts about it and its cultural significance, but I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. Blah 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 blahs. Yeah.
Thank you. Interesting. Okay. Well, Pippin. So Pippin is a really bizarre show. It first came out in 1972, and then was recently revived in, I think, 2012. But the music and lyrics are by Stephen Schwartz. The book is by Roger Hearson, and Fosse is the choreographer of the show. And hot take, I think this is one of the most Fosse shows in terms of how the choreography is presented. Anyway, the story follows Pippin, our white boy protagonist, who is basically on this search to find himself. However, the story is told through the lens of like a circus act. So Pippin is surrounded by all these circus players who are there with him and kind of telling his story with him as he goes. And the whole time he basically goes through all these different avenues to try and find his like one true purpose in life. So he goes to and becomes a soldier in war for a little bit. He dabbles in like a relationship. He just like goes through all these things to try and find the like one thing that is going to give meaning to his life. Spoiler alert, there's not one thing that gives meaning to life, and Pippin discovers that along with the circus players, who are led by a character whose name in the show is just leading player. Where is it going with that? Basically, they're telling the story of Pippin, and it's a circus. And the very end, I'm going to get into this more in my debate section, but the very end, basically, like, everything crumbles apart. The whole show breaks the fourth wall, but the end especially, like, literally takes down the entire stage, and it just bears it down to, like, its bare bones of literally just Pippin on stage. Like, I think he's literally just in pants, like, not even a shirt. And the stage is, like, gone. Yeah, for real. So, yes. Really interesting show. I'm going to give Pippin 9 out of 10. This is a quote from No Time at All, the song Andrea Martin sings in the revival. 9 out of 10. I have 3 more choruses to go.
Okay.
She gets like an applause after the first chorus, and then she's like, I still got 3 more.
I think I'm going to give Pippin 8 out of 10. Yeah.
And I'm going to give Spring Awakening 8.5 out of 10. Blah, 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 blahs.
Good. Awesome. Wow, we have such a debate. I did want us to kind of start off with, like, which protagonist gets the shortest end of the stick, but I think Melchior, like, obviously wins. Or more. It's, like, whichever one you choose.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's, like, a great question to start off with. But I do kind of want to, like, talk about this aspect of it first and maybe, like, why I gave it a lower rating than I was expecting to, like, after reading about it and watching it. So I think, like, when I was first doing this research for this show, I read this Vulture article by Esther Zuckerman about Spring Awakening, like, in conjunction with that NBC show Rise. They, like, do it in the show. I don't know if you remember that show. But the review talks a lot about how, like, young teens, like, really latched on to Spring Awakening, of which I was one. I used to sneak back to our desktop and watch it, like, bootleg on YouTube and, like, turn it off when my parents came back because it had sex in it. It was, like, a big deal, you know? But I really liked this quote from the piece where Esther Zuckerman says, even now, more than a decade later, Spring Awakening touches a raw nerve that takes me right back to when I was an inexperienced, stressed-out junior, hoping that a boy would just notice me. Sheik's melodies tapped into the parts of my brain that loved Richard Rodgers and Death Cab for Cutie in equal measure, and Sater's profane, anxiety-laden words were perfect for the times I was feeling hopeless, desperate, and a little dangerous. And then the review goes on to say that Duncan Sheik said that it was always intended to reach young people. Like, it's meant for everyone, but he really wanted kids to see it, which in my head, it's like, okay. But I understand because, like, as a teenager, and you said yourself, you did too, I think, like, teens, like, really latch on to that show for, like, very specific reasons. And thankfully,
yeah,
I wasn't dealing with the heavier stuff in the show, but there are kids who are. And, like, at a base level, what really drew me to it was just, like, I was like, oh my god, sex, like, they're talking about sex, and I was just, like, very taken aback by that, because no one talks to kids about that kind of thing. But I do kind of want to just, like, touch on the rape scene, I'll just call it what it is, between, Vendla and Melchior, just because it's gone through a lot of iterations, which I didn't know about, and I think it's, like, the hardest, their love story in conjunction with that scene is, as an adult, is, like, the hardest part of the show for me to, like, really grasp and wrap my head around. So just to, like, for some background, in the play, which I've never seen, I don't think they really put it on anymore. And I don't know if, but anyway, so according to Wikipedia on the play, it's, like, pretty explicit what's going on. Like, it's not, like, she is protesting and it's pretty explicit. And then in the off-Broadway production, apparently, Venla did not give consent. And that's different from the Broadway version. Like, she starts off protesting, and then she does. And apparently, audiences were, like, very uncomfortable with the off-Broadway representation of what happened. So they softened it a bit for Broadway and had her, like, go from protesting to she, like, says yes before it happens. But still, even, like, that, I think even as, like, a young kid, I was kind of like, I don't really know what's going on here, but I understand that it's wrong. And as an adult, I'm like, okay, this still spells out, like, what happens to her is rape, even if the 13-year-old boy who's doing it isn't, like, completely aware of what's going on either, right?
Yeah.
But I think, like, not so much the decision to, like, I understand, like, wanting to make audiences comfortable and, like, wanting to have her say yes, even though it's, like, very, very clear that she doesn't understand what she's saying yes to, is an understandable choice. But I think just the whole love story between them, like, framing it as a romantic choice all through the rest of the show kind of makes me feel a little strange, because neither one of them has to really deal. I mean, she has to deal with, like, the literal physical implications of what they've done. She gets pregnant. And he obviously goes to reform school, but they have the guilty ones, but then after that, they don't really necessarily have to deal with what's happened psychologically, because they're too busy dealing with, like, all the other shit that's going on in their lives. And I think, like, the point of the show is dealing with that, like, confused stage of adolescence and how it is messed up, especially when no one's there to, like, guide you and make it easier or make it more understandable. And I think, at least in my estimation, I think they go a little too far in trying to make it feel like they're in love. And maybe that's, like, a product of them being teenagers and they wanted it to, like, feel exacerbated, like teen emotions are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can do that without framing it as, like, a love story. Like, for example, the last song, which, like, is very sad. A lot of people die in the show. It's very, like, heavy. But it's just so positive and, like, very sweet and almost, like, kind of saccharine. And I just don't know if, like, that is what the original play was going for. I don't know. I, like, have, like, it's, like, one of the toughest parts of the show for me to, like, get on board with.
Yeah.
Even though I can understand why they don't want to, like, I'm not advocating for them to, like, show anything worse than what they show. And I understand the choice, like, to make audience more comfortable. But I think it, like, goes a little too far, and then you don't really have to deal with the implications of what actually happened on stage. But,
yeah. Yeah, that's fair. That's really interesting. I don't think I've looked at it from that angle before, and I totally see where you're coming from. I also was a high school, like, Spring Awakening is one of the first musicals that I remember being, like, obsessed with. Like,
same.
That I would listen to, like, every day. Like, to this day, I know every word, every intonation, every beat of that whole show. And it's, like, muscle memory from high school. There's literally a video on my YouTube channel that I made for, like, a high school English project. And I did a whole, like, minute of it was to the song My Junk.
I love that song. Yeah. And I don't think, like, in general, I think this show is probably, like, probably a net positive. Like, it gives, like, a weird theater kid, like, something to, like, really latch onto. And it is, like, geared towards teenagers. Like, he said it himself, it's like you, like, feel, like, cool and edgy because you're like, ooh, this is so, like, oh, like, you know. But at the same time, I think, like, sometimes with some of their darker material, it's, like, hard to make that leap a little bit, especially as you get older. Like, when, like, I think when I was 12 is when, or 13 is when I was, like, sneaking back to this, my desktop to watch this show, and I was just like, oh my god, they're saying fuck. Like, I wasn't, you know, like, I wasn't,
yeah,
like, necessarily
fucked, all right.
I wasn't necessarily thinking of the broader implications of it all.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely something you like latch on to. And I think like, I don't know, there are a lot of things I still really liked about it. I never really liked the microphones. I don't know how you feel about that. I always thought it was kind of dumb, but
I kind of like it, but I understand why. Like, I don't know that it, I don't think it like actually adds that much. I just like the aesthetic of it.
That's my thing. Yeah, maybe dumb is like a, dumb is a harsh word, but I was kind of like, why do we do this? I don't know. But to go into a little bit of positive stuff, I really like the choreography. I think like they do a lot in the way of like, it's not necessarily like super hard choreography, but it does a lot of work in making the actors seem younger than they are, which I really like. Like the way they kind of jump around and like wave their hands, and they have a lot of like intent, but they don't really know what they're doing. Is that what it's like, what it looks like? And I thought that was like super cool, especially on this rewatch, but I don't know. The other stuff I have is kind of about acting. But I don't know. Do you want to jump over to Pippin and we can jump back?
Yeah, I'll talk about Pippin for a little bit and then maybe we can do that. Okay, Pippin. I really love this show. And I actually, so I saw it in Nashville when Sammy and I were in college. And I saw the tour of the revival production. And it blew me away and I loved it. And I've just like really loved a lot of the music as well for a while. So it's always a show that I've thought of really positively. But then when I was like coming to prepare for this, I was like, oh yeah, Pippin, it's a fun show. And I rewatched it and I was like, damn, I fucking love this show. Like there's so many things to it. And I feel like a lot more actually clicked for me this time around watching it. So yeah, a few like high level like thoughts that I have that I want to talk about. The first is the fourth wall. To say that this show breaks the fourth wall is such an understatement, because the whole show is like, the whole show breaks the fourth wall, and it's like kind of to the point where by the end of it you break like the fifth wall by like removing that even barrier, the storytelling breaking the fourth wall barrier. But like from the very first moment in the show, the players that are in the circus literally tell you exactly what's going to happen, to the point where they like announce like events in Pippin's life by re-singing one or two of the lines from Magic to Do, the opening song. So it's like intrigue, plots to bring disaster, humor handled by a master, romance, sex presented pastorally. Like, so they'll literally be like right before Pippin's about to experience like sex and romance. They come in and they go, romance, sex presented pastorally. So yeah, they really like bookmark the show, or bookmark, that's not the right word.
Bookend.
Or like signpost.
Yeah, that works. Bookend.
Signpost, yeah, something.
Yeah, I don't know.
They signpost the show from the beginning, which I think is really cool. And I think that, like, this show easily could have just taken the character of Pippin. So for context, two of the characters in Pippin, Pippin and Charlemagne, are both based on real people. However, they're just based on them. Like, it's not, like, an accurate portrayal of them as characters. It's more just, like, the inspiration. And I think you totally could have still gone with the story of Pippin and stuff, but not had the whole, like, circus spin on it. But I think that makes it really phenomenal and kind of leads me into the second point that I want to talk about, which this one is a total theory on my end. It's not, I'm not, like, I haven't actually read anything that confirms this, but one thing that for me, like, clicked this time around when watching it is this concept of, like, ego death in Pippin, and how the circus players telling that story are like a big part of that. So what I mean by that is, where do I even start? So the circus okay, so to talk about ego death in Pippin, there's this moment where it clicked for me, and I feel like that's kind of what I view the role of the circus players as. So this whole time, the circus is breaking the fourth wall, telling the story of Pippin trying to find himself. But the whole time, concurrently, Pippin is playing this role of Pippin. that the circus players have made. Like, they have written this role into existence, like, in the songs through magic to do and stuff. And Pippin is coming into this and, like, trying to fulfill that role that they've assigned to him. But what he has to do throughout this show is, like, deconstruct all of that. And at the end, it literally takes him, like, about to jump into a fire, which, like, hey, ego death. But he literally, like, has to come to that and deconstruct even the stage, the circus, the puppeteers guiding him, and, like, understand that that's an illusion. And that is, like, that him trying to find this one purpose for himself that is kind of this idea implanted in him by the players, that's not true. Like, and he realizes at the end that what actually matters is the simple joys, a previous song in the show. And while he, like, doesn't necessarily think that he's amounting to this massive thing in life, he's happy just having a simple life on a farm with his wife and son.
Who wouldn't want to live really on a beautiful farm with Rachel Bay Jones?
I know, for real. And at the end, I think it's her, she asks him, like, Pippin, how are you? Like, how do you feel? And he says, trapped, but happy. And that's a really interesting thing. But I think what it shows, what my interpretation of that is, like, there is still, like, a sense of regret, maybe, in Pippin for, like, all of these missed, for his life not leading up to this one big purpose that he'll be remembered by. But at the same time, him searching for that was not making him happy. And so at the end of the day, like, what's more important to him is, like, yeah, maybe there's a bit of him that's trapped and he feels like he's settling into this box. He's, like, also experiencing joy. So actually that's what, and the reason that that last line, I texted Sammy when I was watching Pippin and I was like, maybe we didn't name this category right. So I don't know that you can totally say that Pippin's story ends badly, but it just involves a lot of deconstruction of self and isn't, like, an outwardly positive ending. He just kind of, like, it's crazy because the show opens with this, like, absolutely mind-bogglingly beautiful, stunning, and, like, insane choreo with this unbelievable circus set. And the show ends with, like, literally nothing. Like, it's just Pippin on stage and his wife, and then the very end, it's just their son, actually. Yeah. And it kind of implies this cyclical process.
I was about to say, could you say it kind of ends badly then? If, like, because I kind of take the, when he says, like, trapped but happy, I kind of took that as to be, like, you can't escape. And then the thing with the son at the end, so, like, the players come out for the son, basically, at the end. And, like, I kind of took that to mean as, like, you can't, like, fully escape pressures around you, like societal pressures or whatever is, like, pulling the strings, but whatever one you get stuck in, like, pick the one that makes you happy.
Something that's a really interesting take.
Like,
I took that for me, the way I interpreted that, and I'm gonna bring it back to the hero's journey, which I talked about a couple episodes ago, which is that I think everyone, I think it's just, like, inescapable for people to have to go through some form of finding themselves. And I think that looks different in everyone. For a lot of people, that means looking into trauma. For a lot of people, it means finding their purpose, like, whatever that means to different people. And I think that part for me was more so, like, this is a universal story, and it doesn't end with, it's not about Pippin, and it doesn't end with Pippin. Like, his kid is just about to experience this next iteration of him finding himself. And so they, at the very end, they bring back the keys of magic to do, and the chorus comes back out, and they're, like, kind of imply that the whole show is going to start again with his son. So I think that, to me, that just kind of alludes to the fact that we're all on this journey of discovering self, and there are, like, similarities in all of our journeys.
And that kind of, so, like, at the beginning when Pippin first comes out, they're like, it's his first night. Like, it's his first night on the job or whatever. And so, like, I don't know. It's so, it's like a circle. It's cool.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, so those are just two, like, big themes that I really enjoy. I'll go into talking about some of the, like, specifics within the show that I love. First, I wanted to read this thing I found, actually, though, that Stephen Schwartz said. I found this, like, thing of him responding to, like, Q&As, basically, about Pippin. And I really liked this, like, description of what Pippin is about to him. So yeah, I'm just going to read it.
Okay.
Basically, Pippin is about a young man in search of what to do with his life. But like many of us in contemporary society, particularly those with enough economic freedom to allow choice, he has the illusion that there is one particular choice which, if only he finds it, will lead to complete fulfillment and contentment. He has not yet learned that it is the process of seeking that contains the joy, not the attainment of the goal itself. He also is quite selfish in his pursuits at the beginning, as most of us are when we're young. It isn't until he learns to give himself to someone else, Catherine and her son, that he begins to find a sense of inner peace and self-worth. Ultimately, he realizes that the demand for something without flaw or compromise is not just self-defeating, but ultimately self-destructive. He must come to accept that life is never perfect, and that what we have to do is find something and someone to care about, devote ourselves to that, and do the best we can. In other words, he grows up. I know a lot of this answer is couched in 90s psychobabble, but I hope you will understand what I mean, and I hope it proves helpful. Best, Stephen Schwartz. I thought that was really cute, and I thought that was a really, like, a really well done summation of what Pippin is, because he's just trying to find himself. It's nothing like spectacular, and that's kind of the whole point too, is he isn't a spectacular person, but he's searching for this extraordinary purpose in a way that maybe there just isn't one, and that doesn't have to be a negative thing, but it's more so like not building up those expectations. Anyway, I wanted to read a few things that I want to talk about. First of all, magic to do. So that is how you open a motherfucking
show. It's a great opener. Like, wow. Like, and it, like the circus, all the choreo and like the tricks, whew, it just like catches you immediately.
It's so much. Yes.
Yeah.
Also, one thing I want to talk about too is the revival version of this. That's the version I watched in preparation for this. Although I have seen the original one as well. It's available on YouTube, like a professionally recorded version of it. And I love both. But I think that this is an example of like how you nail a revival. Like you're not just putting up the same show, you're reimagining it and like updating it with both like the Broadway polish changes that have changed since the 70s, but also with like material, with themes and stuff. And I think that this show really does that. The first big thing, for people who don't know, the original leading player was played by actor Ben Vereen. Amazing. Oh, he won incredible. The Tony for it. But the revival, it's the leading player is played by actress Patina Miller, who I have talked about on our Sister Act episode. I absolutely love Patina Miller. I saw a play and she sat like three seats from you there. It was a show about Gloria Steinem. Gloria Steinem was also there. It was amazing.
Gloria? Is it the?
Yeah.
I want to see that. I can't now.
Amazing.
But yeah.
Yeah. I really, really loved it. Yeah. Anyway, so what? And Patina Miller also won the Tony for her portrayal as of leading player. This is actually the only Broadway show that has someone win the Tony for best actor and actress for the same role, which is really cool.
That's awesome.
But I think that they really nailed it. Patina Miller, to me, this is like, I view this, her role in this, as like one of those perfectly cast once in a lifetime type situations. And like, I am not at all here to downplay Ben Vereen's icon status in his role in general, but also specifically in Pippin, because he originated the fuck out of this role and killed it. But like, to me, it's so like now inseparable, like for me in my mind, Patina Miller's portrayal of this role. And I think she just like nails it down to a T. I wrote when I was watching this, that is how you win a fucking Tony, which it's true. And she won. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think you're right about the, like, this is how you do a revival. And I think what's really cool about it is it does update stuff, but it has something that is incredibly iconic, aka fussy mm-hmm. choreography. And, like, you can't just, like, change that altogether. Yeah. And I think it does a really good job at, like, honoring that status of it and honoring everything else that's great about it while still updating it. And I think a lot of revivals don't, like, I mean, we talked about, like, the West Side Story revival, which, like, mm-hmm. tried to, like, was, like, really ambitious and tried to, like, update something and tried to, like, make it, you know, more of this time. And, like, maybe in some ways it succeed, maybe in some ways they don't. And I think that's, like, usually probably, like, the best way to go with a revival, to just try to be, like, super different. But I think this is really cool because it stays, like, pretty close. Like, I watched a lot of, like, videos of the older one and, like, watched parts of the newer one. And it stays, like, pretty close to what it was, but still mm-hmm. feels fresh. It's cool.
It yeah. feels so fresh and brand new. And it just also feels like, again, like I was saying, not that the revival cast is, like, better. It just is so much more polished in the way that we've made advancements in, like, set and choreo and costuming yeah. on Broadway over the last, what, 50 years. Yeah. Okay, and then one more thing I want to talk about, then I'll give it back to you, is
okay.
In the revival, Andrea Martin, mm-hmm. she also won a Tony for Best Supporting Actress. She plays, oh my god, I can't even think, it's this weird name, it's like an old-timey name. It's Bertha? Not Esmeralda.
Is she Bertha?
Bertha, yeah. Bertha.
Bertha? I don't know.
That's not that old, it's Bertha, Berthy, I don't know. Anyway, she plays Pippin's grandmother, and the whole, like, message that she portrays, that she gives to him, is that there's, like, no time at all, so live in the present. And the way that she does this is by doing this, like, crazy-ass number, like, an acrobatic number, and Andrea Martin fucking is, like, flying over the stage with this guy, like, at one point, holding her. She's like free flying in the air, probably like 15 feet above the ground, not being held on by anything except this guy while she's like doing these different poses. That's the one where she goes, I have three more choruses to go. This is another one that really breaks the fourth wall too, because she quite literally invites the audience to join her. However, she notes only on the choruses. The verses are hers, which I really like. But they have the words pop up on the, like, the stage for the audience to sing along with on the choruses. But then the way she ends the song, one of the last lyrics is, I believe if I refuse to grow old, I can be young until I die. And I think that's, like, a really, like, I think that she is a big lesson for Pippin that I don't think he actually, like, takes in until the end, because his whole thing is that he's not living in the present. He's, like, mm-hmm. looking for this obscure, not real thing that's going to give him his purpose, when this whole tea is, she's like, if I refuse to think about that and to, like, go towards this, you know, whatever that Pippin's looking for, and just live in the present and, like, do all this acrobatic shit, which makes me feel happy and sexy with this man, like, that's what I can do, and that's how I can stay young, despite being, I don't know how old she is in this, but, like, very old in the show.
yeah.
So, yeah. Those are my thoughts on Pippin.
All right. I have a few other things to say about Spring Awakening, but mostly about, and how, like, I was looking over my notes, and I think I was maybe too harsh on it, and I kind of want to bump my rating up to a 7. But mostly because I think I just watched it and got, like, really bogged down in, like, the way, which I think is fair, like, we should, like, think about how sexual assault is handled, but, like, I don't want to say I got bogged down in it, but, like, it was, like, very much on my brain when I was watching it. But I was reading a couple reviews from the time, and this is one of those things that I, like, this is stupid, but I almost don't think adults should review this show, because, like, you just, like, the way you think about it when you're an adult, like, an example of how I'm thinking about it right now, and, like, the way you think about it when you're a kid are so different, and the way you latch onto it when you're a teenager are so different, and I think it's important to have both perspectives, mm-hmm. but I, like, can't get out of my heart, like, how much I felt for this show when I was, like, 13, And so I was reading, it was a New York Times review. It was from Charles Isherwood, who I think I've used one of his reviews or a couple of his reviews before on this show. But he had a quote, and he was kind of talking about the acting. So for context, like the central stars of the show are, I'm going to just say the main three. Moritz is John Gallagher Jr. of Newsroom fame. Hello, Sorkin heads. And he's also been in a ton of other stuff, on Broadway and off and on screen and stuff. And then you've got Jonathan Groff. Of course, we all know, we all love him. Who's Melchior. And then Vendla, who's Lea Michele, who, like, you know, of Glee fame. Rachel Berry is her name. So he has this quote kind of about the way those three function. And just he uses those three because they're, like, the central characters, but then kind of making a broader generalization about how the rest of the characters act as well and the actors. And he says, and the necessary reduction of Wedekind's text, which that was the guy who wrote the play, and I kind of talked about that before. I do think they kind of, like, have to reduce it a little bit. And he says this on in his quote. He says, the reduction of the text to make room for the show's nearly 20 songs, we lose some of the play's subtle elliptical structure and its characters' intricate psychology. Just kind of what I was talking about before with, like, as far as they don't ever really have to deal with the implications of what, of, like, the sexual encounter they've had. And then he goes on to kind of center down on the acting a little more, and he says, the central trio, the anxious misfit Moritz, the good student, sorry, I'm gonna start over. The central trio, the anxious misfit Moritz, the good student Melchior, and Melchior's sweetly curious girlfriend, Vendla, questionable to call her a girlfriend, in my opinion, he says, do not really emerge as fully human figures. They're more like singing vessels for general adolescent anxieties. So it's possible to follow them to their individual dooms with entirely dry eyes. And I don't think he's wrong. Like, I think they do, like, serve as, like, kind of a character for, like, a teenager to project their anxieties onto, but I don't think that's a bad thing. Like, I think that's what they're going for, is, like, for a teenager to watch it. And using myself as an example, like, I have never been a, like, pregnant teenager worrying about the fate of my unborn child, and still, when Lea Michele sings Whispering, I am able to project on her, especially as a 13-year-old. And I think that is, you can't discount the importance that that has in a teenager's life, like the ability to project onto a character like that. And so I think that he's not necessarily wrong in the fact that they operate as kind of these, like, and they act like that too. Like, they're very, like, I mean, you don't have Lea Michele on stage and she's not, like, exaggerating the fuck out of every, you know what I mean? Like, but they're doing that for a reason. And I think he pinpoints what they're doing, but, like, sees it from a very adult perspective, which he is an adult, that makes sense. But as a 13-year-old, you are just projecting all your own shit onto them, and it completely works because the emotions are so high and so volatile. So I think, like, this is just to show that, like, it's, like, kind of those books you read in high school. Like, I don't know, like, did you read, like, Catcher in the Rye when you were in high school, and, like, all those boys in your class were like, oh my god, this is the best book ever, and you were kind of like, okay, and then you read it as an adult and you're like, this guy's a little shit, like, what are you talking about? Like, it's one of those things, and I don't feel that strongly about Spring Awakening. Like, I still enjoy Spring Awakening, but it's one of those things where I think if you see it as a teenager, it has, like, a different impact than if you just saw it as an adult. Yeah, I'm gonna up my rating to a 7. I feel kind of bad. But I think, like, the way they act is actually, like, a really, really good choice on their part, especially if they're aiming towards, like, a teenage audience. Yeah. I don't know. That's mostly what I have. Like, I can go through the songs.
I have such a special place.
I know, me too. It, like, really means a lot to me, even though I kind of, like, shat on it a little bit. But it means a lot to me. I'll go through my bop list a little bit, which, like, I will say I still really enjoy most of the music in this show. Like, Mama Who Bore Me reprise.
Wait, pause. What is, on three, your favorite song from Spring Awakening?
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
One, two, three.
My Junk.
Dark I Know Well.
Okay. Really?
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. I know. That was like my high school depression song.
I did not put that on my bop list because it is, it's so dark.
It's so good, though.
It is really good, but it's so dark. But you know what? I'm not going to lie. I did listen to that as a teen and be like, I don't even know. I don't have the time to unpack the psychology of that. Jesus Christ. Anyway, I'll go through my adult bop list for Spring Awakening. I think it also has a really good opening. Like, it starts off with Justly and Michelle on stage, Mama Who Bore Me. And I would be remiss, there was a, wasn't there the deaf production of this a few years ago that won some Grammys as well? Which, mm-hmm. if you can, like, look up videos of that online, the way they use, like, the singing actors.
It's and really, the it's staging is so cool.
So beautiful and really, really moving and cool. But I'll go ahead and go with the bop list. I just, like, didn't... I told myself I mentioned that. I wanted to remember. But, so, I think the opening is really good. Like, Mama Who Bore Me just kind of... It's very sweet and very, like, oh, like, this is girl, she's singing. And then it gets into the reprise and you're like, oh, shit. Okay, this is what we're doing. All right. I like the dichotomy there. It had The Bitch of Living. That was my, like... they're singing about masturbation time when I was 13. My Junk, which I still adore that song. I think it's great. Touch Me, which again was a scandalous favorite of mine. I put The Word of Your Body on here with a little asterisk because I don't necessarily think it's a bop, but I think it's a really good song. But it's not like necessarily one I'll just like jam to. The Mirror Blue Night. Love that song. Don't Do Sadness / Blue Wind. That was probably my sad middle school bop. Like, when I was really sad, that's what I would listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Totally Fucked, which I would play when I was mad at my parents. So, yeah.
Not Song of Purple Summer?
Oh, yes, that too. Sorry, I have that on here. I also really, I struggled with, like, putting Left Behind on there. Because I really like that song, but it's so sad.
Yeah.
And I don't know, have you seen that video of Jonathan Groff talking about the time he forgot the words to that song? Oh my
God. Yes.
All things. Ugh,
I love him.
I love him so much. Shout out to Groff Sauce. All right.
Groff Sauce. Okay, I'll just do my Pip and Bop list and we can go into the recreate. Pip and Bop list, Magic to Do, hands down. Corner of the Sky, one thing I didn't talk about that I need to say here, that actor in the revival, what's his name, Matthew James?
Something? I was going to say Matthew Taylor Thomas, that's not it, that's Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Matthew James Thomas.
Yes, I think so.
Something like
I'll
that.
I'll look it up, you keep going.
Anyway, in the last note of Corner of the Sky, it's like, gotta find my corner of the sky. And he does one of the most insane things I've ever seen in my life. He starts that last note, which is already so hard to sing, like in total head voice. And I timed it. He holds it for 16 minutes, the whole time crescendoing.
16 minutes?
And by the end, it's like 16... Oh. 16 seconds.
I was like, dude.
He holds it for 16
is
seconds.
Is he dead?
And crescendos the whole time until he's at a full-out belt at the end. Yeah. It's insane.
It's crazy.
Glory, some absolute amazing Fosse choreo. It's also such a cool portrayal of war. Like, it's very circusy, and it's just so funny to see, like, a war conqueror, like,
whoa,
to show that by him, like, jump roping over his enemy. Like, okay, Simple Joys. No Time at All, Spread a Little Sunshine, Morning Glow, On the Right Track, Kind of Woman. This is Rachel Bay Jones' first song in the show. She destroys it. If anyone's a Seth Rudetsky fan out there, there's a video that he does with Rachel Bay Jones basically talking about how she turned Kind of Woman, which for him in the original and for me as well, was just kind of like a boring skip kind of song. And she just, like, totally changes the ending and, like, squelts it. And in a really powerful way, though. It doesn't feel, like, out of place. Yeah, watch that. She kills it. Extraordinary. I Guess I'll Miss the Man. And then the finale.
Awesome.
Great songs. That's my bop list.
Yeah. I think Glory might be, like, one of my top five favorite songs of musical theater. I love it so much.
It's just, like, it is
incredible.
The truth.
Yeah. All right. Should we move on to the recreate? Mine is kind of silly.
Yeah, let's do it.
I always say that, but it's silly. So a couple, or more than a couple, a few episodes ago, we talked about, or I talked about, how I thought it was crazy that there was, like, a high school-friendly version of Heathers. And I was trying to think of other weird musicals that could have a high school-friendly version. So I thought, why not try to make the high school-friendly version of Spring Awakening? So I don't think there's necessarily a way that you could make Spring Awakening not about sex and coming to terms with sex. So that's staying. It's just going to be, like, really, really sanitized. And I was thinking of, like, trying to change some plot points, but it's really dark and I didn't want to, like, make light of it in that kind. I don't know. I didn't want to, like, go into that and, like, try to make this kind of, like, weird thing, so I just took some lyrics and I'm gonna sanitize them for you. So, starting with the beginning of The Bitch of Living, or not the beginning, but the first verse, the part that's blatantly about masturbation, where they go, she said, give me that hand, please, and the itch you can't control. Let me teach you how to handle all the sadness in your soul. Oh, we'll work that silver magic, then we'll aim it at the wall. She said, love may make you blind, kid, but I wouldn't mind at all. So basically my whole thing with all of these lyrics pretty much is to make them less about sexual frustration and more about, like, teeny bopper crushes. So we're going to change that whole section into, she said, give me your heart, please, and the love you can't control. Let me teach you how to handle all the sadness in your soul. Then we'll work through all those feelings as the hours start to crawl. Love may make you stupid, but I wouldn't mind at all. And then another line from Bitch of Living is, it's like just kiss some ass, man, and you can screw them all. That becomes, it's like just be a nice guy and you can have it all. And then we have from Word of Your Body, kind of crazy song, but it goes, there's a line that says, I'm going to bruise you. Are you going to be my bruise? It's a duet between Melchior and Bendla. And I've changed it to, I'm going to love you. Are you going to be my boo? Yeah. And then, I told you, this is silly, but here we go. And then, of course, we had to do Totally Fucked. So I just took the chorus. Yeah, you're fucked, all right, and all for spite. You can kiss your sorry ass goodbye. Totally fucked. Will they mess you up when you know they're going to try? They basically just changed a couple words. So, yeah, you're done, all right, because the whole song is about how Melchior's fucked because they found this essay that he gave to Moritz about sex. So he goes, yeah, you're done, all right, and all for spite. You can kiss your sorry life goodbye. Totally done. Will they mess you up when you know they're going to try? And then the last one I did was from Touch Me, which is explicit, or at least in the way it's sung. It's, like, very breathy and moany.
And staged.
Yes. It's a lot. So the lyrics of the chorus go, touch me just like that and that. Oh, yeah. Now that's heaven. Now that I like. God, that's so nice. Now lower down where the figs lie. God, blushing, I feel like a 13-year-old. Okay. So I just made that less about sexual gratification and more about a first kiss. So it goes, kiss me just like this. Now one more time, that's heaven. That one I liked. That was so nice. Now one more time, don't think twice. So if you're looking for a version of Spring Awakening to do at your high school that you need watered down, I guess, call me.
Okay, I'll hit up Bishop Lynch High School. That's where I went to high school. I also, my one contribution,
version, so.
My one contribution would be, I think it'd be really funny if Totally Fucked was the exact same, but it was just totally
they
beeped.
Go.
Yeah, you're well, that's beeped, a, that's all a, right.
At the, don't they do, at the Tonys, weren't they like, yeah, you're all right. They just like
yeah.
put their hands
and
their
they
mouths.
Just like cover their mouth.
Yeah, and didn't
the
say
Gen, the Gen Z like mouth slap.
Yeah. All right, I'll keep that in mind.
I love it.
Thank you.
Okay. So for my recreate, okay, so the starting point for this is that I think that the revival of Pippin might, I don't know if I've thought about this enough to say this definitively, but I think I can say that it might be my favorite revival like I've ever seen, mm-hmm. and one of the like best done revivals of a show in terms of like keeping true to the source material, but also modernizing and elevating, etc. So then I was thinking, oh, another key, I think one of the key parts of its success was Patina Miller and gender bending the lead role.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things we have, revivals, gender bending the lead role. I decided I would come up with a list of shows and talk a little bit about what it could look like to both shows that I think I really want to see revived on Broadway, and that I would love to see revived with some sort of gender bend take on it. So awesome. Here are the shows. This one I feel pretty strongly about, which is maybe a wild card, Book of Mormon. Here's my backing. Okay, so 25% of Mormon missionaries are women, but in Book of Mormon, they would have you believe that it is only men. So I just think that the lead Elder Price should just become a woman in the show. And I think, A, it would be really interesting. Like, first of all, could you imagine someone belting I Believe? Oh, my God, that would just be, like, music to my ears. Yeah. But also, I think it would be a really interesting, like, way to show some of the nuances of, like, what women missionaries have to deal with that guys probably don't.
Mm-hmm.
Next show, Evita. And for this one, I think it would be really interesting for the role of Che to be gender bent. Che, for those of you who didn't tune into our Evita episode, Che is
episode
like the
11,
narrator. Yes, 11. He's like the narrator of Evita. He's like loosely based off Che Guevara, but is actually decidedly not him.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I just would love to see that, and I would love to see how, if and how that changes the way the audience views Eva. Yeah. Next one, Drowsy Chaperone. I would love to see Man in Chair be Woman in Chair. For those of you who aren't familiar with Drowsy Chaperone, it's basically this show about this really old, like, not really old, but this old, like, kind of like alcoholic, cynical, kind of crazy guy who likes listening to musicals from the past, and he listens to this one and it comes alive on stage. So part of it's the like that show, but part of it's him listening to that show and interacting with it. Anyway, I think that's I don't have a huge explanation. I just think that would be one where it'd be really interesting. But I could see that being like a really good role for, oh my God, why am I blanking on her name? Laurie Metcalf.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That.
Next show, Gypsy. Imagine Gypsy with like a gay theater stage dad.
Papa Rose.
Like, yeah. Neil Patrick Harris. I don't know. next one. I have a feeling you're going to love this one.
Oh,
so this one technically wouldn't be a revival because it's never been on Broadway. But I would love to see The Hunchback of Notre Dame redone. And I would love to see a woman on stage because I would like a big part of what that character struggles with is like feeling ugly. And I feel like you could have a really interesting perspective on body image that is more aligned with like what a woman might experience. I'd be so interested to see that. Plus Esmeralda being I just feel like that would be really great.
I was in that show. It was a little bit of a fun experience. Parts of it were hard. But he has Honestly, The Hunchback of Notre Dame has some of, like, the best Disney music, I think, like, of the Disney canon. It has really great music. Wow, that would be fun.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, three more. Last 5 years. So we kind of talked about this, I think, a little bit on our last 5 years episode, but so many parts that we talked about in the episode deal with gender roles. And I would love, at first I was like, okay, maybe we just change one of them and make it a queer thing. But then I was like, actually, I want to keep it, but I want Jamie and Kathy's storylines to just be switched. Because I think that it would be so interesting to see that show where the man is struggling with confidence in his career and the woman is succeeding and experiencing success. Like, I don't know. I would love to see that dynamic and see if that changes the way I feel about the show. Two more. Next one, Aida. I thought it would be really interesting if we gender bent the character of Adam Pascal. What is it?
Radames.
Yeah. And have kind of like a little like lesbian trio triangle going on.
I love it.
And also, I just like desperately want a revival of Aida on Broadway and one that's done with like all black cast members.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
We'll love to see it. We'll see. And then lastly, Hairspray. I thought it'd be really cool if Edna Turnblad, that character becomes, I don't know what the male version of Edna is. I said Edmund. So Edna Turnblad becomes Edmund Turnblad and is played by a woman.
Amazing.
And also, Hairspray hasn't been revived yet.
You're right. It hasn't.
So I would love to see that.
Those are so good. I like those.
Thank you.
That was fun. Wow. Wow, that was a good episode, I think, besides some technical difficulties.
It was, I hope so. I know, right? We'll see how that sounds editing.
I know. But, all right, I have the next and last week pulled up. Oh, my God. Okay, are you ready for the category?
Wow, can you believe next week is the last? Yeah, I am.
I can't believe it. Okay, I'm going to drumroll. Ready? Bada-bada-bada-bada-bada-bada-bada. The category is shows where the protagonist has surprise child/children.
Ooh la la, what could it be? A hint I'll give is that I think we're both going out with a bang.
I do too. I'm excited. I haven't watched this in a long time, but there's one.
I am too.
I'm not going to give too much away, but one part of it makes me cry a lot. So, okay. I'm excited. All right, well.
That'll be for next week.
Let us know what you think. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. We love you. See you next week.
Thank you. Bye.